The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, I'm Sharon Silcox. Welcome to That's a Laugh. I'm Sharon with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today, I'll be reading from the book, My Nest Isn't Empty. It Just Has More Closet Space, The Amazing Adventures of an Ordinary Woman by Lisa Scottolini with Francesca Scottolini Saratella. The back of the paperback edition by St. Martin's Griffin tells us the incomparable Lisa Scottolini, along with daughter Francesca, is back with more wild and wonderful wit and wisdom in this hilarious collection. They give their mother-daughter perspective on everything from blind dates to empty calories, as well as life with the feistiest octogenarian on the planet, Mother Mary, who won't part with her 30-year-old bra. Three generations of women, triple the laughs and the love. I'll start with a short essay titled, The Right to Choose. Let's talk about a decision that women have to make every morning. Big purse or little purse? I know it's not life or death, but it makes you nuts if you choose the wrong one as consistently as I do. If you carry a big purse for the day, it's guaranteed that you'll end up never needing anything you're lugging around like a pack animal. And if you carry a little purse for the day, you'll invariably end up tucking things under your armpit or asking your husband to carry them. It's purse lotto, and there are winners and losers every day. I lose, almost always. I keep track. And if I choose the right purse 4 days out of seven, I'm purse diva. Most weeks, I choose correctly only one day, purse geek. Now, I can already hear you menfolk thinking that the problem can be solved by a medium-sized purse. That seems sensible, but it doesn't work. Not your fault, gentlemen. How would you know? Unless you carry a man purse, in which case, play along. In reality, a medium purse is the worst of both worlds. It's not big enough to carry everything you need, and it's not small enough to let you feel footloose and fancy-free. And besides, medium defeats the purpose of adding fun to your life by gambling with handbags. So I say, live dangerously. Choose big or little. Pick your poison. See if, by the end of the day, you're a purse hero or a purse loser. Use me as your inspiration. You couldn't do worse. Just the other day, I chose a big purse and ended up walking all over New York City with daughter Francesca, carrying the weight of the world on my shoulder. I didn't need the hardback book, full makeup case, or water bottle. Turns out they have water in New York, too. So the next day, I carried a cute little purse, but wrong again. I couldn't zip it up after I bought a pack of gum. So I walked everywhere, worried that my keys would fall out or I'd get pickpocketed. And Francesca had to carry our umbrella, newspaper, and everything else in her nice big purse. It goes without saying that the day you choose the wrong purse, your daughter will choose the right one. Last week, Francesca was 6 for 7, purse diva. It was the same week I got so frustrated that I opted out of purse lotto altogether. Francesca and I went to a movie, and I carried only my wallet. Whoa! I threw caution to the summer wind. I was free and easy, like July itself. Francesca looked over. Why no purse? Traveling light. You should carry a purse, Mom. Don't need one. We settled into our seats at the movie, and Francesca gestured at my wallet. Where are you going to put that? I blinked. The seat to the right of me was taken, and my cup holder held a Diet Coke and Raisinets. I could not admit defeat and ask her to put my wallet in her big purse. So I set the wallet under my chair on the sticky floor. Yuck. See, I said, hiding my distaste. No problem. It worked out perfectly until we left the theater, got several blocks away, and I remembered that my wallet was still on the floor. We hurried back, and it was still there, probably because even felons couldn't unstick it. Then we went out to dinner. Now where are you going to put the wallet? Francesca asked, lifting an eyebrow. Right here. I set it down on the empty chair next to me. No problem. I didn't forget it either. But when we had gotten a few blocks from the restaurant, I realized that I'd been so worried about my wallet, I'd left my credit card on the table. We hurried back for the second time that day. So now I lose at wallet lotto, too. I should have brought a purse, I said, going home after all was recovered. Next time, Francesca patted me on the back. Don't feel bad. Which purse should I have brought, Osage One? The small purse genius. The next story is titled Braless in the ER, the sequel. So the other night, right before bed, I was standing with my dogs in the backyard, and here's what happened to me. A bug flew in my ear. You heard that right, but I didn't. I heard nothing but a loud and freaky fluttering. Do you follow? I don't mean that a bug landed on my ear and flew away, which would hardly be worth whining about. What I mean is that a bug flew into my ear and got stuck inside my head. Can I just say that I freaked out? I ran around the yard, yelling and shaking my head so hard that my glasses flew off and broke. Great. I slapped my ear with my hand, but the bug just kept fluttering, giving me the creepiest case of swimmer's ear ever. I figured it was a moth because it sounded like it had big wings, and it tickled, not in a good way. I shivered. I shuddered. I was grossed out. I couldn't stand still, nor could I deal with the fact that there was a moth inside my head. I tried to remember from Biology 101 if the moth could fly into my brain, but I was pretty sure that it had to stop at my eardrum, which was already starting to itch, hurt, and maybe even vibrate. Okay, that could have been my imagination, because there was a moth inside my head. I didn't know what to do. I considered sucking it out with a vacuum cleaner, but I don't have the kind with the hose, only the kind you roll on the floor. I thought about pouring water into my ear, but then I'd end up with a soggy moth. I tried to pull it out, but it was already in too far, and I was worried I'd push it in even farther, maybe to my cerebellum or eyes. I didn't do so well in Biology 101. Then it seemed like the moth was going farther inside my noggin. Hitting myself in the temple wasn't doing anything but giving me a headache. I tried to stay calm, but every time the moth pounded its wings, it sounded like a helicopter. Okay, maybe that's an exaggeration, but still, it was scary, like that horror movie where the fly crawls up the girl's nose. I tried to decide whether I'd rather have a fly up my nose or a moth in my ear, but I was too panicky to think. I ran back inside the house and danced around, yelping and trying to knock the moth out. The dogs watched with varying reactions. The Goldens sat calmly, waiting to go upstairs to bed. But little Tony and Ruby the Corgi started barking and running around, a canine version of me. Also, I was dog-sitting Pip, daughter Francesca Spaniel, and though he remained quiet, his bored expression told me he wished he'd stayed at a hotel. So I drove at breakneck speed to the emergency room, and thank God there was almost no one on the road because the moth went into winged overdrive, and I yelped and squirmed the entire way. I explained everything to the nice receptionist ladies at the hospital, who told me that this happened all the time and were kind enough to understand my need to keep moving. It was the people in the waiting room who raised an eyebrow, thinking I was having seizures. And I didn't take offense when one of the nurses asked if I had taken any street drugs. By the way, for those of you who recall my last trip to the emergency room after my dog bit the hand that feeds her, I had yet another super hot male nurse, and yes, I was braless while middle-aged, which would be the bad news. The good news is that while they took my blood pressure, the moth flew out of my ear. One nurse gasped, and the other laughed. At least the moth didn't fly out of my other ear. And you know what? I killed the moth. I felt instantly guilty, but he deserved it. Then I went home, once again, happily empty-headed. The next day, the receptionist called to tell me that I had left my driver's license and insurance card at the hospital, and she asked me whether I'd write a story about the moth. You think? Next up, Nutty. Addictions sneak up on you. They lure you in, teasing you. And before you realize it, you have a craving you can't deny. I'm talking, of course, about nuts. I'm nuts about nuts. It might be a seasonal thing. Come fall, I gather nuts with the single-mindedness of a backyard squirrel. I buy bags and bags, then settle down with a single gal trifecta of a Diet Coke, a good book, and the nut du jour. We're chasing the dragon, ladies. My habit started when I was young, and my gateway drug was sunflower seeds. They're labor-intensive, which is nature's attempt at portion control. Futile. Nature's no match for me, jonesing for sunflower seeds. Everybody eats sunflower seeds in a different way, and I split mine with my teeth, then amass a tiny pile, like a little gray treasure. When I have about 25 seeds, I shove them in my mouth all at once. This very attractive process used to take me about 10 minutes, but after years of practice, I've become a sunflower seed professional. I can do 25 seeds in 3 minutes. Don't try this at home, or if you're married. And I never cheat. That is, I never buy sunflower seeds already shelled. If I did, how else would I get that fine layer of filth under my fingernails? Of course, no nut was as messy as the old school pistachio dyed red. I don't know who thought it made sense to dye pistachio nuts red, but I'm guessing it was the same guy who used to dye Easter chicks pink. You remember what would happen if you ate red pistachios. Your fingers would be red for days. It wasn't a nut, it was a tattoo. When I was little, Brother Frank and I used to eat tons of red pistachios. Nowadays, we know that the red dye on pistachios causes cancer, or at least a lifetime of celibacy, so we eat the normal browned kind. They're meaty and delicious, and many of them come out of the bag partway open, which is helpful. Occasionally, you run across a closed pistachio, and if you do, here's my advice. Move on. There's nothing for you there. Don't even try to open a closed pistachio. Tenacity doesn't begin to describe these hardy few. You could use a clam shucker, a blowtorch, or a nuclear weapon, but in the end, the closed pistachio will defeat you. Instead, calm down and have an almond. It will take your mind off the closed pistachio, and it's always easy to crack, though it's disappointingly healthy. Walnuts fall into the same category. It's no fun to be addicted to something that's good for you. Being addicted to something healthy is like loving exercise. Go away. Peanuts are also delicious, and because they properly belong in Snickers, they're naughty enough to qualify as an addiction. It was my beloved father who taught me to eat peanuts, by which I mean he always ate the whole peanut, shell and all. It was the only way I knew to eat peanuts until one night when I popped a whole peanut and everyone started pointing and laughing. You don't eat this shell, silly, they all said. So I stopped. Not eating the shells, just eating the shells in public. Love you, Dad. My all-time favorite nut is the pumpkin seed, especially the kind that comes coated with hard salt, white as packed snow, but with a higher sodium content. And they're so salty, they practically demand another Diet Coke in a vicious yet familiar salt-sugar cycle. Once I start eating pumpkin seeds, I can't stop. They take as long as a sunflower seed to shell, yet are less satisfying since the seed is merely a sliver. It is just enough meat to keep you wanting more, yet never enough to satisfy completely, even after 25 seeds or 50. Pumpkin seeds are the crack cocaine of the nut world, and I need an intervention. Now it's time for some diet advice in Take Your Medicine. I'm trying to remember when food became medicine, because everybody knows that food is love and comfort and a reward. The idea that food is medicine might have started with all this talk about antioxidants, which evidently aren't things that prevent rust, but things you have to eat every day, like a magic pill that wards off all manner of dreaded diseases. Then I started hearing about free radicals, which was another thing to be avoided, although to a person of a certain age, a free radical is Abby Hoffman or Jerry Rubin. Young people will have to look up those references. I suggest the World Book Encyclopedia, now housed under glass at the Smithsonian. Bring a quill. Anyway, I wanted to learn about antioxidants and free radicals because I don't want to die or get rusty, so I bought a book about superfoods, which explained that blueberries and beans were better for you than potato chips and popcorn. Who knew? I studied the book, which says that you should try to eat these superfoods every day, like more magic pills, and it listed the good things in each superfood, or maybe the super things. For example, I learned that blueberries have magnesium, turkey has zinc, oats have manganese, wild salmon has selenium, walnuts have arginine, and tomatoes have chromium. Wow, I would have thought that only cars had chromium and batteries had selenium. And magnesium is something in an Etch-a-Sketch. And zinc is something you smear on your nose to prevent sunburn. I'd never even heard of arginine, which clearly belongs on the periodic table under the chemical symbol TASTES, TERRIBLE. So now when I plan a meal, I don't think about what tastes good or what I feel like eating. I ignore all my cravings and all the dishes that make me feel happy. No food in a TV commercial tempts me because it's guaranteed that nothing in Kentucky Fried Chicken has chromium. Instead, I select dosages of superfoods and rotate them around for a week of super meals. Super? Which brings me to quinoa. A friend of mine was raving to me recently about quinoa, saying how good it is for you and how much protein and fiber it has. So I went immediately to the store to get some. I couldn't find any because I was looking for something spelled like K-E-E-N-W-A. And all they had was something clearly pronounced like quinoa. The salesperson told me that Q-U-I-N-N-N-O-A-H was really K-E-E-N-W-A. And who am I to complain? Because try spelling scatolini. Plus, I'm getting the idea that if you can't pronounce it, it definitely has antioxidants, and none of its radicals will be free. Free Angela. Again, look it up. So, I take home the box of quinoa, boil it up, and dump it onto a plate where it mounds like snow. And not white, new-fallen snow, but second-day snow after the plow has gone by, shoving it up against your car. Yummy! It tastes like nothing, or maybe it tastes like antioxidants, or maybe just like rust. I dress it up with sautéed tomatoes, which ward off diseases, and garlic, which wards off a sex life. So far, so good. And I told myself that it didn't matter if I didn't like the quinoa, because I'm not allowed to like my food anymore anyway. And in time, I got a cookbook all about quinoa, which taught me that it was some kind of grain discovered by an American guy who went to Bolivia, because then it grew only in the Andes, which I thought was a mint, but back to my story. And although the American guy brought quinoa seeds back to the United States to try to grow them in Colorado, he still imports the seeds from Bolivia because we had the correct altitude but not the correct latitude. Then I realized that I didn't have the correct attitude. I want to be open to new foods, even ones that double as medicine. So I tried to change the way I think about antioxidants and free radicals. And I sprayed a little lemon on the quinoa, and it wasn't so bad for old snow. More family craziness in Batman and Robin. I just got off the phone with Mother Mary, and I don't understand anything we said. It seems impossible that we communicate so badly, and I can't blame it on the cell phone. Bad reception, or a faulty connection. The faulty connection comes with the family. We talked for about 15 minutes, both of us speaking English, which is our first language, but it was as if we were having two different conversations, and I can't figure out when we took a wrong turn to conversational crazy town. It started innocently enough, with me calling her to say hello, to which she replied angrily, "This cat is so spoiled!" "Really? Why?" I asked, surprised. To interject some background, I've never heard Mother Mary get angry at the cat. At the dogs? Yes. And my brother? Yes. At the cable company? Yes. And the humidity? Yes. And the double parking on their street? Yes. Also at the city of Miami? Yes. And all politicians whom she regards as crooks and drunks? Yes, yes, yes. She wakes up angry, then spends the day accumulating reasons therefore. Retirement, Scatolini style. Andy Rooney is a piker compared with Mother Mary. He's merely cranky, which is kid stuff in our dotage. We don't do curmudgeonly. The flying Scatolini's aim higher for generalized hostility. Many people take up a hobby in their golden years. Our hobby is aggravation. Can't wait. But Mother Mary never gets angry about the cat. She and my brother, whom you may recall lived together in South Beach, love their cat, a skinny Siamese who's 16 years old, named Puddytat. In their defense, they didn't pick the cat's name. We're crazy, not stupid. She peed on your brother's bed, my mother was saying. When did she do this? All the time. Really? When did it start? A year ago. What? Why didn't you do anything about it? She does it on purpose. So I'm thinking, what difference does that make, and why are you so mad about it now? But I didn't say anything for fear her head would explode, and I was already figuring that the cat is 16, which is probably 3,000 years in cat years, and nobody can vouch for their bladder after their 200th birthday. I got my own problems, and I'm only 54, if you follow. So I said, Mom, maybe you should take her to the vet. She's so spoiled. I make her shrimp, and I have to boil it. She won't eat the canned. And now your brother came home with a bedspread. I can't sleep a wink. I tried to follow. It was like a string of non sequiturs connected by changing tenses. Ma, slow down. What does the shrimp have to do with the bedspread? There's bats everywhere. In the house? They'll be fresh, she snaps, even more exasperated. But I'm not being fresh. I'm being confused. Ma, where are the bats? On the bed. There's like 1,000 that keep me awake. Bats? Real bats? He makes bat noises. It's not funny. On the phone, I hear my brother call out, Batman and Robin. To interject again, my brother shouts in the background on most of our phone calls, and for that, I'm grateful. I love him. And he's like my personal translator, fluent in Mary Scottolini. But I'm still confused. Also, please note that nobody in my family ever explains anything. You have to cross-examine them, then piece the story together yourself. I'm trained as a lawyer, and this is difficult, even for me. Ma, what about Batman and Robin? How am I supposed to sleep with bats? My brother calls out. I got her a Batman and Robin bedspread. It came with a coloring book. I can't believe I'm hearing this right. She's 86. Ma, why did they get you that? It has bats on one side. All bats for him. He got one with trucks and cars. My brother calls out. They were on sale at Ross. My mother calls back. I can't sleep with bats, he shouts to her. So turn it on the Batman side, she shouts back. And have Batman lying on top of me? Okay, so this is about where I check out of the conversation. The picture of Mother Mary in bed with Batman burns itself into my imagination, and my mother and brother are off and running anyway. At some point, I suggest they take the cat to the vet and the bedspread back to Ross. I don't know what they did with a coloring book. The next story is about computer woes and what is really important. It's titled Crash and is written by Francesca Scottolini Saratella. It happened all so fast. One moment, everything was normal, and then black, then white, then a blinking folder icon with a question mark inside it, and then I knew. My computer crashed. I sat frozen at the cursor on the screen. I came out of my catatonia after a few minutes, but my laptop remained non-responsive. I managed to access the web on my cell phone and Google a description of my problem, but what I found was not good. Words like hard drive failure and, you got the question folder of death. Looks like your Mac is on its way to the Big Apple store in the sky. I felt my gorge rise. I was near hyperventilating. I thought I might cry. There was only one logical thing to do. I called Mom. Are you okay? She answered, alarmed. It didn't occur to me until then that it was after 2 in the morning. I'm fine, but oh my God, are you hurt? Where are you? Mom, I'm fine. I'm home. Did something happen to the dog? No, listen. I paused to find the strength. My computer just crashed. I heard my mom give her a trademark irritated huff. Honey, go to sleep. We'll deal with it in the morning. Wait! Did you hear me? I really think it's dead. Tomorrow, we'll call tomorrow. Now, come on, go back to sleep. Good night. Click. I was so frustrated with my mother at that moment. But once calm, I had to recognize that the generation gap was to blame for her lack of sympathy. My mom uses her computer for work, email, shopping for books online, and Googling images of puppies. I have my entire life on my computer. Every photo from the last 6 years, thousands of music files, all of my notes and schoolwork from college, my household budget, my date book, my address book, my everything. So I began the odyssey of the 21st century, self-discovery via data recovery. First, I called the Apple Store, and they told me the only genius appointment available was at the Uptown store at 4:20 p.m. Going to the Apple flagship store on a Sunday afternoon is the retail equivalent of telling someone you'll meet them in Times Square on New Year's Eve. I stood on my tippy toes to peer above the heads and spotted the glowing screen that read Genius Bar, the North Star for all desperate Mac users. I popped out from the tightly packed crowd like a watermelon seed between two fingers and threw myself prostrate before my appointed genius. He took my laptop with hipster apathy. As he was opening my computer, hooking it to various wires and life support, he asked, "So, what happened when it crashed?" "I was just using the internet. I didn't drop it or anything. All of a sudden, it froze." "What were you doing right before it froze?" I hung my head. I would have to confess my sins. I was doing something online that is so shameful, so embarrassing, I could hardly say it. I was brought up better than this. I thought no one would know. I was in the privacy of my own home, but now, busted, I told him. I was putting my name into the Jersey Shore nickname generator. I was unmasked as a reality TV junkie. I once used that same laptop for my Harvard thesis. My computer didn't crash, it quit. So I waited while he typed at superhuman speed, plugged and unplugged, booted and rebooted. No more than a few minutes had passed when he looked up and said, "Okay, I think we're done." My heart swelled. "Did you fix it?" "No, your hard drive failed. It's dead. Can't get anything off it." "Nothing?" "Nope." "How could this happen? I didn't drop it or do anything to it." My eyes welled with tears, which elicited a look of concern or maybe fear. "It's not your fault. Some day or another, all hard drives die. Some just days out of the box, some years. There's not always a reason, just like with people." I couldn't point out the illogicality of his statement. I was too busy weeping. "Don't cry. 20-something guys hate when girls cry. Do you back up?" "For the record, if someone tells you through tears that their computer crashed, do not ask them, do you back up? Not helpful." "I back up my work files, but not any of my personal stuff." "Maybe it should be the other way around." Whoa, deep. It was the first genius thing he'd said all day. It reminded me of my mom's first two questions on the phone. I couldn't see it then, but she had the priorities straight. I'm okay. The people and animals I love are okay. The lost files I miss the most are photos of those same people and animals. Pip's puppy pictures, my grandmother at my graduation, my road trip with my college roommates. But my old roommate is coming to visit. I just spoke with my grandmother, and Pip is curled in my lap. The data may be lost, but I have the hard copies. That's all we have time for today. Join me next month for That's a Laugh. I'm Sharon Silcox with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website at trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.